Special Agent Mayfield and I are out here to report on anti-government subversives, and I need to warn you that anything you say may be held against you in a military tribunal. Mark managed a weak smile. Allison said to me, I think you're being provocative again. It must be my aftershave lotion. Allison actually giggled. I think she liked me. Also, I strongly suspected she was the Friday night screamer. The third woman, Pam, asked both of us, have you ever arrested a terrorist? It seemed like a normal question, but by Pam's tone of voice and the general context, it could be taken in another way, which is how Kate took it. Kate responded, if you mean an Islamic terrorist, no, but she stood and hiked up her pullover, exposing a long white scar that began under her left rib cage and continued down to the top of her butt. She said, a Libyan gentleman named Assad Khalil got me with a sniper rifle. He got John, too. My scar was along my right hip, and short of dropping my shorts, I didn't see how I was going to show this in mixed company. Kate pulled down her sweater and said, so no, I never arrested a terrorist, but I was shot by one. And I was at the Twin Towers when they were hit. The room got a little quiet, and I thought maybe everyone was waiting to see my scar. I did have the three bullet holes from the Hispanic gentleman that ended my NYPD career. Two holes were indecently located, but I had one in my chest that I could say was from the Libyan, because I really wanted to unbutton my shirt to show Allison my wound. John? Huh? I said, I'm ready to go. I smell sausage cooking. I want to get an early start. Right. I stood and said to everyone, we're off to Plum Island. You know, the Biological Warfare Research Lab. There's like 8 liters of anthrax missing, and we have to try to figure out where it went. I added, that could be nasty if a crop duster sprays it over the vineyards, or I coughed twice and said, excuse me. So, have a nice day. We left the quaint house and walked to my Jeep. Kate said, you're not supposed to say things like that. What? You know what? She laughed, which she wouldn't have done before 9/11 or 6 months after. Now, as I said, she was a different woman, and she'd loosened up a lot and finally appreciated my rapier wit and sophisticated humor. She noted, you are so fucking immature. That wasn't exactly what I was thinking. We both got into the Jeep, and off we went. She spoke in a deep bass voice, which I guess was an imitation of me. There's like 8 liters of anthrax missing. Do you have a cold? She continued, that could be nasty if a crop duster sprays it over the vineyards. She coughed twice. Excuse me, I think I have anthrax. I didn't say that. Where do you get this stuff? I don't know. It just pops into my head. Scary. Anthrax is very scary. I mean, your head. Right. So, where to? I asked. I know a great antique store in Southold. Let's go to church. It's cheaper. Southold. Make a left here. So, we spent Sunday morning antiquing. I'm not a huge fan of antiques, which I think are mostly verminous chunks of rotten wood and unsanitary scraps of germ-infested fabric. I'd take my chances with anthrax before antiques. Needless to say, we didn't buy anything. In fact, Kate commented, why do I need to buy an antique? I'm married to one. We had lunch in a diner where I finally got my bagel, plus the sausages and eggs I'd missed at breakfast. After lunch, we hit a few more wineries, where we picked up a dozen bottles of wine that we could have bought in Manhattan for the same price, and then we stopped at a farm stand. We rarely eat at home. She can't cook, and neither can I, and I don't eat fruit or vegetables. But we bought a ton of this stuff with leaves and dirt on it, plus a 50-pound bag of Long Island potatoes. I asked, What are we going to do with all this crap? You run over a deer, and I'll make hunter's stew. That was actually funny. Why didn't I think of it? We collected our belongings from the B&B, settled the bill, and started back to the city. She asked me, "Did you have a good weekend?" I did, except for breakfast. You need to talk to people with opposing views. I do. I'm married. Very funny. She asked, "Why don't we go upstate next weekend?" Good idea. Which reminded me to ask her, "What do you know about the Custer Hill Club?" I didn't buy your last response. She considered the question and the statement, then replied, "I know that you almost spent this weekend there." Meaning what? Well, Tom Walsh asked me if I'd have an objection to him sending you there on a surveillance. Really? And you said? I said, yes, I would object. She asked me, "How did you know about the Custer Hill Club?" From Harry Muller, who got the assignment. What did he tell you? I'm asking the questions. Why didn't you tell me about this? Tom asked me not to, but I was going to tell you. When? Now, on the trip home. Yeah, right. Why didn't you want me to go? I was looking forward to getting away with you this weekend. I didn't know about that either until about 4:30 Friday. I'd been thinking about it. You were actually scrambling to find a place to stay on short notice. I informed her, "You're talking to me, darling. You can't bullshit a bullshitter who's also a brilliant detective." She considered that. Well, I just didn't like the sound of the assignment. So I told Tom we had plans, and then I needed to make plans. I digested all of this and asked her, "What do you mean you didn't like the sound of the assignment?" "I don't know. Just instinct. Something about Tom's demeanor. Can you be more specific?" "No, I can't. But thinking back on it, I may have read too much into what he was saying. Also, I didn't want to be alone for the weekend." "Why didn't you volunteer to come with me?" "John, just drop it. I'm sorry I lied to you, and sorry I didn't tell you sooner."
"Apology accepted if you tell me what is the Custer Hill Club."
"I'm not sure, but Tom said it was a social and recreational club composed of rich and powerful men."
"I might have had a good time."
"You were supposed to take photographs of..."
"I know all that. What I don't know is why these men need watching."
"I really don't know. He wasn't going to share that information with me." She added, "You can assume they're politically conservative, and maybe radically so."
"That's not a crime."
"That's all I know."
I was on the Long Island Expressway now, heading west into the sinking sun. The Jeep smelled like a Korean produce market, and the wine was rattling around on the floor behind me. I thought about what Kate had said, but I didn't have enough facts to draw any conclusions. A few things stuck out, however, such as the political orientation of the Custer Hill Club and the upscale membership. The crazies on the right who actually engage in criminal activities are almost always of the lower class variety. Their clubhouse, if they have one, is a gas station or a shack in the woods. This group was apparently something quite different. And that's about all I had at the moment. And if I was smart, that's all I needed to know. And if I wanted to know more, I could ask Harry in the morning. Kate said, "I think you're annoyed at me for not mentioning that Tom and I discussed sending you on the assignment." "Not at all. I'm happy that my career is in such good hands. In fact, it's sort of touching to think of you and Walsh discussing if little Johnny should go away for the weekend."
"John,
maybe you should have said it was okay with you, but he should check first with his wife to see if it was okay with her."
"Stop being an idiot."
"I'm just getting warmed up."
"Just drop it. It's totally unimportant.
Go tell Walsh that I told you and that you're not happy with his management style." "That's exactly what I'm going to do."
"Don't be confrontational. Try being diplomatic."
I'll be very diplomatic. I asked, can I put him in a headlock? We drove in silence a while. I realized I should speak to Harry before I confronted Walsh in the morning. I dialed Harry's cell number on my hands-free phone. Kate asked,
who are you calling?
My emotional stress counselor. After 6 rings, Harry's voice came on the line. This is Detective Harry Muller. At the tone, leave me a message and a phone number where I can reach you. Beep. I said, Harry, it's Corey. Kate wants to make Hunter's stew. I got potatoes, vegetables, and red wine. One of us has to run over a deer for the rest of the recipe. Call me ASAP. I hung up and said to Kate, that surveillance could have been a career builder if I didn't get eaten by a bear. Maybe that's why Tom wanted you to go. To help my career or get me eaten by a bear? Do you have to ask? I smiled. We held hands and she turned on the radio to an easy listening station. We made small talk on the way back to the city. As we approached the Midtown Tunnel, the lit skyline of Manhattan came into view. Neither Kate nor I commented on the missing Twin Towers, but we both knew what we were thinking. I remember that one of my first coherent thoughts after the towers were hit was that a man who pulls a knife on you doesn't have a gun. And I recall saying to a cop next to me, thank God, this means they don't have a nuclear bomb. The cop replied, not yet. Part 8. Monday, New York City. In America, there are factions, but no conspiracies. Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, 1835. Chapter 16. It was Columbus Day, a special day to celebrate a dead white male stumbling onto a continent on his way to someplace else. I've had similar experiences coming out of Dresner's bar. We were dressed casually today. I had on comfortable loafers, black jeans, a sports shirt, and a leather jacket. Kate was also wearing jeans, with boots, a turtleneck, and a suede jacket. I said, your handbag doesn't match your holster. Well then, I need to buy a new handbag today. I should learn to keep my smart mouth shut. Kate and I exited our apartment house on East 72nd Street, and Alfred, our doorman, hailed us a cab. Holiday traffic in Manhattan was light, and we made good time down to 26 Federal Plaza. It was a beautiful, clear, crisp fall day, and I hummed a few bars of Autumn in New York. Kate asked me, do you know if Tom Walsh will be in today? No, but if you hum a few notes, I might recognize it. You're a jerk. I think that's well established. The taxi driver, a fella named Ziad al-Shehi, was speaking on his cell phone in Arabic. I put my finger to my lips and leaned forward. I whispered to Kate, he's talking to his Al-Qaeda cell leader. He's saying something about Columbus Day sales at Bergdorf's. She sighed. Mr. al-Shehi signed off, and I asked him, do you know who Christopher Columbus is? He glanced in his rearview mirror and replied, Columbus Circle? Columbus Avenue? Where do you want to go? You say Federal Plaza. You never heard of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria? Sir? Queen Isabella, for God's sake. Are you marching in the Columbus Day Parade? Sir? John, stop it. I'm just trying to help him with his citizenship test. Stop it. I sat back and hummed Autumn in New York. It being a federal holiday, the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force was not fully open for business, but Kate had decided to go in anyway to keep me company and catch up on paperwork. We'd have lunch together, then she'd leave to catch the Columbus Day sales. Even when we're working the same schedule, we don't always travel to work together. Sometimes, one of us takes too long with our makeup, and the other one gets impatient and leaves. Kate had the Times in her briefcase, and I asked her for the sports section, but she gave me Section A instead. The front page headline read, Rumsfeld favors forceful actions to foil an attack. The story went on to explain that the U.S. needed to act early during the pre-crisis period to foil an attack on the nation. It seemed to me that if Saddam was reading the Times, he'd call his bookie and bet on an invasion in late January. The other big story was the car bombing of a nightclub frequented by Westerners on the Indonesian resort island of Bali. This seemed to be a new front in the war of global terrorism. The death toll stood at 184, with more than 300 injured, the largest loss of life since September 11, 2001. The Times acknowledged that the attack was probably the work of Islamic extremists. Good guess. Good New York Times word, too. Why call them terrorists or murderers? That's so judgmental. Adolf Hitler was an extremist. We weren't going to win the war on terrorism until we won the war of the words. I turned to the Times crossword puzzle and asked Kate, "What's the definition of a moderate Arab?" "I don't know. A guy who ran out of ammunition." She shook her head, but Ziad laughed. Humor really bridges the gap between different cultures. Kate observed, "This is going to be a long day." As it turned out, she was right. Chapter 17. Harry wasn't at his desk when we got to 26 Federal Plaza at 5 to 9, and he wasn't there at 9:15 or 9:30. As per my last conversation with him, he was supposed to see Walsh today. Walsh was in, Harry was not. The office was quiet for a change, and I counted 3 NYPD at their desks and 1 FBI, Kate. Also, the command post center, elsewhere on the 26th floor, would be manned by at least 1 duty agent monitoring the phones, radios, and internet. Hopefully, the terrorists were leaf-watching in New England for the long weekend. I called Harry Muller's cell phone at 9:45 and left a message. Then I called his house in Queens and left a message on his answering machine. Then I beeped him, which in this business is official. At 10:05, Kate came across the floor and said to me, "Tom Walsh wants to see us." "Why?" "I have no idea. Have you spoken to him yet?" "No." Kate and I walked to Walsh's corner office. The door was open, and we entered. Walsh stood and met us halfway, which is usually a sign that you're not in deep dew. He motioned us to the round table near the window, and we sat. The table was strewn with papers and folders, very unlike when Jack Koenig occupied this office. On his big picture window, about where you could once see the Twin Towers, was a black decal showing the towers with the words 9/11, never forget. It was, as I said, a nice fall day, like the one a year and a month ago when the attacks happened. If it weren't for the meeting at Windows on the World, Jack would probably have been here in his office and witnessed it as it happened. David Stein, too, would have seen it from his corner office. As it turned out, they saw it from much closer. Tom Walsh began, "John, the computer security people informed me that you used your password to try to access a restricted file on Friday."
"That's right."
I looked at Walsh. He was young to be the special agent in charge, about 40, black Irish, not bad looking, and unmarried. He had the reputation of being a ladies' man and also a teetotaler, making him an Irish queer, a guy who preferred women over whiskey. He asked me, "What is your interest in that file?" "Oh, I don't know, Tom. I couldn't get into it, so I don't know if I had any interest in it." He stared at me, showing a little impatience, I thought. I used to think I didn't like Jack Koenig's Teutonic style, and I thought I'd like Walsh, being half Irish myself, but this was a case of the job shaping the man, nurture over nature or whatever. He said, "What the hell is Iraqi Camel Club Weapons of Mass Destruction?" Just me being silly. I glanced at Kate, but she wasn't amused, only confused. I see. He looked at Kate, his fellow FBI straight arrow, and asked her, Did you mention that surveillance to John? I did, but not until Sunday. Walsh said to me, So, Harry Muller mentioned it to you. You never rat out a brother cop, so I replied, Harry Muller? What's he got to do with the custard... What's it called? All right. It's irrelevant anyway. I agree. And while I'm here, can I make a formal complaint about you asking my wife for permission to send me on an assignment upstate? I wasn't asking her permission. I was just extending both of you a courtesy. You're married, and I wanted to see if this interfered with any personal plans you had for the holiday weekend. Next time, ask me. Fine. Point made. Why did my name pop into your head? Walsh didn't seem to want to discuss this, but he replied, Obviously, I thought you'd be the best man for the job. Tom, as you may know, the last rural surveillance I did was in Central Park, and I got lost for 2 days. He smiled politely, then said, Well, I was thinking more in terms of other aspects of the surveillance. Such as? Well, for one thing, the surveillance involved trespassing on private land without a warrant, which is right up your alley. Also, this place, the Custer Hill Club, has good security, and there was a chance of the surveillance person being stopped and questioned by private guards, and I knew you could handle that. He informed me, The members of this club are people with some political influence in Washington. I was beginning to see why no one wanted to ask a judge for a search warrant. Aside from that, there seemed to be a disconnect between what Harry Muller told me, routine surveillance, file building, and so forth, and what Tom Walsh just said. Since Harry would not lie to me, I concluded that Harry had not been fully briefed by Walsh. I said to Walsh, So, bottom line, you needed a cop to take the fall if anything went wrong. That's totally not true. Let's move on. Tom Walsh looked at both of us and said, We haven't heard from Harry Muller. I had figured that's why we were all in his office, but I had hoped it wasn't. Were you supposed to hear from him? Only if there was a problem. Sometimes, Tom, when there's a problem, that's when you don't hear. Thank you for your insight. Okay, let me tell you what I know. He began, Harry Muller, as you know, left here before 5 p.m. Friday. He went to tech support, got what he needed, and went to the garage for his camper, which he'd taken to work in anticipation of this assignment. Jennifer Lupo happened to see him in the garage. They exchanged a few words, and that was the last person we know who saw him. He continued, The next time he was heard from was a cell phone call he made to his girlfriend, Lori Bonick, at 7:48 a.m. Saturday morning. There was a recording device on the table, and Walsh hit a button. Harry's voice said,
Hi, babe. It's your one and only. I'm up here in the mountains, so maybe I won't have good reception for very long, but I wanted to say hi. I got up here last night about midnight, slept in the camper, and now I'm on duty, near the right-wing loony lodge. So don't call back, but I'll call you later from a landline if I can't reach you by cell phone. Okay? I still need to do something at the local airport later today or tomorrow morning, so I might need to stay overnight. I'll let you know when I know. Speak to you later. Love you.
Walsh commented, So we know he got there, and we know he was near the subject property. At 9:16 a.m., she called him back and left a message on his cell phone, which we recovered from the phone company. He hit the button again, and Lori Bonick's voice said,
Hi, honey. Got your message. I was sleeping. I'm going shopping today with your sister and Anne. Call me later. I'll have my cell with me, okay? Let me know if you have to stay over. I love you, and I miss you. Be careful of those right-wing loonies. They like their guns. Take care.
I said to Walsh, obviously you've spoken to her. Yes, this morning. She told me that at about 4 p.m. Saturday, she received a text message from Harry on her cell phone which said, he glanced at a piece of paper on the table and read, sorry I missed your call. Bad reception here. Ran into some friends. Fishing and hiking. See you Monday. None of us raised the obvious point that the text message could have come from someone other than Harry. But apparently Laurie thought it was from him because Walsh informed us she was not happy. She called him when she got the text message and he didn't answer. She continued calling and leaving messages and also paged him 4 or 5 times. Her last message to him was Sunday evening. She described to me her messages as increasingly angry and emotional. She told him if he didn't return her calls, they were through. I asked him, at what point did her anger turn to worry? At about 10 p.m. Sunday night. She had the after-hours number here and called. She spoke to the FBI duty agent, Ken Riley, and told him about her concern. I nodded. I've gotten calls like that from girlfriends, boyfriends, husbands, and wives. You do the best you can to determine if there actually is a cause for concern. In about 100% of those cases, the loved one was not dead, but would be when he or she got home. Walsh continued, Ken tried to reassure her, but girlfriends don't get the same courtesy as a wife or family member, so he didn't offer much assistance. He did take her number and told her he'd call her back if he heard anything. He actually tried Harry's cell phone and beeper, but got no response. Walsh added, he wasn't concerned. In truth, there was no reason why he should be, except for Harry's failure to answer his beeper. On the one hand, it was the weekend, and agents have been known to forget their beeper, or to be in, say, a loud bar or quiet bed where the beeper may not be noticed or acknowledged. On the other hand, Harry was on duty. I said, maybe the problem is just bad reception. Walsh nodded and continued, when I got here at 8, I pulled up the weekend duty agent's reports and saw Ken Riley's entry about Laurie Bonnick and Harry Muller. I wasn't concerned, but I called Harry's cell phone and house and beeped him. Then I called Ms. Bonnick and spoke to her. Then I made a few other calls, including one to the FBI field office in Albany. I asked the SAC in Albany, Gary Melius, to begin a missing agent response, and he said he would, though I sensed he wasn't quite sure if Detective Muller was missing in action or missing on purpose. In any case, the SAC notified the state police, and they in turn were to notify the local police, who know the area but don't have a lot of manpower. They're checking local hospitals, but so far, no admissions under that name, and no unidentified admissions. He looked at Kate and me, trying to determine, I guess, how this was playing with us, and, by extension, how it was going to play when he related his immediate responses to people higher up the chain. He continued, the state police ran Harry Muller through DMV, and they have the make, model, color, and plate number of his camper. As of 15 minutes ago, the vehicle hasn't turned up, but it's a huge wilderness, and it may take a while even if the vehicle is still in the area. Kate asked, is his cell phone or beeper giving off any signals? The phone company is still working on that. As of now, the answer is no. As per my conversation with Harry, I knew he was supposed to be here this morning, but Walsh hadn't mentioned it yet, so I asked him, was Harry supposed to report to you today? Yes. He was supposed to drop off his equipment and his digital camera discs to tech no later than 9 a.m., then see me for a debriefing. And yet, you're not quite at the point where you're worried. I'm concerned. But I wouldn't be surprised if he called right now or walked into this office. I would. Harry Muller would not miss a meeting with a supervisor. Walsh didn't respond. I wasn't too thrilled with Tom Walsh's laid-back management style, but new guys on the job needed to be careful not to call the director of the FBI to report that the sky was falling. And, of course, there was the other dimension to this problem, which was the Custer Hill Club itself. If Harry Muller had been staking out Abdul Salami in the woods and disappeared, the response would have been very different. Also, to be cynical, if Harry Muller was FBI and not NYPD, the response may have been a little quicker, holiday weekend notwithstanding. In fact, FBI agent Ken Riley may have called Tom Walsh on Sunday night. Not that the safety of a cop is less important than that of an FBI agent. It has more to do with the unfortunate and partly deserved reputation of New York's finest being free spirits. I asked Walsh, "Do you think Harry's disappearance is directly related to his assignment?" Walsh had a ready answer. "I don't want to speculate on the nature of his disappearance. But if I did, I'd say that it's possible that Harry Muller met with an accident. There are millions of acres of wilderness in that area, and it's possible that he's lost or hurt. He could have broken a leg, stepped in a bear trap, or even been attacked by a bear. And from what the Albany SAC told me, people up there sometimes hunt off-season. Harry was most probably wearing camouflage and may have been accidentally shot by a hunter." He continued, "There are all sorts of dangers in the wilderness. That's why it's called the wilderness." Kate commented, "That's why it's not a good idea to send someone there alone. He should have had a partner." Walsh replied, "In retrospect, that may be true. But I've run dozens of rural surveillances with a lone agent. The Adirondacks are not the African jungle." "But you just said, don't second-guess me on this. This is standard procedure, and you never raised that issue when we discussed sending John. Let's address the immediate problem." I thought Walsh was the immediate problem, so I addressed him. "Tom, what exactly is the Custer Hill Club?" He considered a moment, then replied, "I don't see how this relates to finding Harry, but if you want an answer, from what I know, which is not much, it's a very private and exclusive hunting and fishing club, whose members are mostly wealthy, or powerful, or both. You also said they had political influence." "That's what I was told. I'd say the membership is about half Washington and half Wall Street." "Where do you get your information?" "I was briefed. Don't ask." He added, "I'm sure the actual and complete list of club members is not public information, which is why someone in the Justice Department wanted a surveillance of this meeting." "Who called you?" "That's actually none of your business." "Good answer." Regarding Harry's phone message to his girlfriend, I asked Walsh, "What was Harry supposed to do at the airport? Which airport?" Walsh hesitated before he responded, then said, "Adirondack Regional Airport. Some of the people who were to attend this weekend gathering probably arrived by commercial carrier. They have commuter plane service there. Harry was to go to the airport Saturday or early Sunday morning and get printouts of the passenger manifests." I nodded. Walsh forgot to mention that airline passenger manifests could be accessed from anywhere the airline had a computer, or even right here from 26 Fed with the airline's cooperation. Therefore, Harry's other assignment at the airport was to find out who arrived by private or chartered aircraft. And then there were car rentals, and a copy of those rental contracts would be very useful in trying to determine who may have attended this meeting. I was starting to think I might want to follow up on this myself. In any case, Tom Walsh changed the subject. "The state police have search aircraft with infrared sensors to locate large living or recently dead organisms. They're highly trained and equipped to find persons missing in the woods." "That's good." It was my turn to change the subject, and I pointed out to Walsh, "You seem to suggest that this was a routine assignment, and yet you're here on a holiday to meet and debrief Harry. And apparently, Tech is open to receive his digital camera discs and videotape, which I assume will be transmitted to Washington ASAP, along with whatever he came up with at the airport. What's your point? What is the urgency with this surveillance? I have no idea. I just follow orders like you. Actually, you don't follow orders, but I do. He advised me, you need to only ask questions that will help you complete your assignment. He further informed me, our job is to gather intelligence. Sometimes we know why. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we're told to act on intelligence. Sometimes someone else acts on it. How long has this been going on? Quite a while. As always, there's a slight clash of cultures between the FBI and the police, which is frustrating to everyone, I'm sure. Kate said to Walsh, Tom, I've worked with a lot of NYPD since I've been on the task force, and I've learned a lot from them, and they've learned a lot from us. Actually, I've learned next to nothing from the FBI, though the CIA is interesting. Kate continued, since 9/11, we need to think differently, to ask any questions we want to ask, and to challenge our supervisors when we're not satisfied with what they're telling us. Walsh looked at her a while, then observed, I think someone is setting a bad example for you. No, what happened a year ago is what has changed how I think. Walsh didn't respond to that. Let's return to the subject of the missing... Kate interrupted and went into her lawyer mode. Tom, I still don't understand why this group is under surveillance. What illegal activity or federal crime are they suspected of? Whatever they are suspected of has nothing to do with Harry Mueller's apparent disappearance, and therefore you have no need to know. I butted into the argument. This is a reactionary group, correct? Right-wing loony lodge. He nodded. So, considering that, and the high-level political and financial membership of this so-called hunting and fishing club, maybe we're talking about a conspiracy to take over the government. He smiled and replied, I think they already did that on election day. Good point. Meanwhile, we'd really like to know what headquarters told you. Walsh considered that for a moment. Okay, for what it's worth, what I was told was that this had something to do with a conspiracy to rig oil prices. The guy who apparently runs the club is Bain Maddox. You may have heard the name. He owns and operates Global Oil Corporation, GOCO. He added, that's more than you need to know. I processed that. The name was familiar, and oil price rigging was not unheard of. Still, that didn't completely explain the existence of the Custer Hill Club, or even the club members, for that matter. Something was a little off here, and Tom Walsh wasn't going to put it straight, even if he could. Nevertheless, I said to him, I read your memo. That's encouraging. I pointed out, I thought that Iraqis were on the front burner.
That's right.
So? What does the Custer Hill Club have to do with Iraqis or the coming war?
Nothing, as far as I know.
Harry's assignment came about because of the weekend meeting at this club, which I assume doesn't happen that often. Are you having trouble following this? Sorry, I was all set to act on your memo and wrap a rag around my head and hang around an Iraqi coffee shop today.
Forget that.
Let's return to the problem at hand. Quite frankly, I have not yet reported this missing agent to headquarters, but very soon someone there will inquire about the information they asked for. When that happens, I'll have to explain that I'm temporarily out of contact with the agent assigned to the job. That's not going to be a pleasant conversation, but if we catch a break between now and then, I might be able to offer some positive news. I said, Kate and I would like to go upstate and assist in the search. I'm sure I wasn't Tom Walsh's first choice to take this assignment, but I was on duty today. Plus, he knew Harry and I were friends. Also, he needed an FBI agent on the spot ASAP, and Kate had made the mistake of coming in for half a day on a holiday. And voila, Walsh could tell Washington he already had a team on the way upstate. Walsh said to me and Kate, I thought you'd want to do that, so it's all arranged. Good. We'll leave as soon as possible. He checked his watch. In fact, you're leaving in about 5 minutes. There's a car downstairs to take you to the downtown Manhattan heliport. An FBI helicopter will take you to Adirondack Regional Airport. Travel time is about 2 hours. There will be a Hertz rental car at the airport in John's name. When you get there, call me, and I'll give you further instructions. Kate asked, Do we have a contact person there? You may. He added, Agents from Albany and from here will be joining you tonight or tomorrow. I inquired, Have we gotten a search warrant for the Custer Hill Club? The last I heard from our office in Albany is that they were trying to find a U.S. attorney on the holiday, who in turn needs to find a federal judge who wants to work today. Have they tried the saloons? Walsh continued, The U.S. attorney will need to convince a judge that this is a federal case, and that he or she should issue a search warrant for the Custer Hill Club property, which is about 16 square miles of land, but not the lodge itself. We're not going to get that without probable cause, and we have no reason to think that Harry Mueller is in the house. Kate said, We don't need a warrant if there's an immediate danger that a person's life may be in jeopardy. Walsh agreed. I'm sure the owner, Mr. Maddox, would consent to a search for a person who may be lost or injured on his property, and we'll go that route first. But if Maddox is not cooperative, or just not available, and an employee of the club doesn't know what to do, then we'll execute the warrant for the property search. I asked, And how do you explain to Mr. Maddox that you may have a federal agent missing on his property? He doesn't need to know it's a federal agent. We'll leave the property search to the state police. He added, Obviously we're trying to do all we can, short of alerting Maddox that he's under surveillance. I pointed out, If Harry was detained by the security people at this club, then Maddox knows he's under surveillance, Tom. First, there is no evidence and no reason to believe that Harry was detained at the Custer Hill Club. But if he was, then he'd certainly stick to his cover story. Which is? A lost bird watcher. I don't think that's gonna fly. Pardon the pun. I asked, And what if these security people searched him? Was he clean going in? Walsh hesitated, then replied, No. But what are the chances that private security people are going to physically search a trespasser? Or that Harry would allow that? I don't know, Tom, but I wouldn't want to find out the hard way. If I had gone in, I wouldn't be carrying my Fed creds and Glock. I reminded him, cops impersonating drug dealers don't have their gun and badge with them. Walsh didn't seem to appreciate the lecture. He said to me, First of all, the Custer Hill Club is not a drug den, so don't use your NYPD analogies where they're not appropriate. Also, let's assume Harry was not stopped, detained, or searched by the private security people at the Custer Hill Club. Okay, so let's assume he's lost or hurt on club property. The state and local police should be conducting a land and air search right now. What are we waiting for? We're not waiting, John. We're taking it a step at a time, and they are searching the wooded area outside the club property. He stared at us and said, I personally don't think we're going to find Harry on that property. And neither do you if you think about it. Let's be rational, and let's try to balance our concern for Harry against our need to keep Mr. Maddox in the dark. I replied, I'm not seeing much light here myself. This is no different than any other assignment. You get as much light as you need to take the next step into the dark. Sounds like bullshit to me. It's actually official policy. Kate said, John, we need to get going. Walsh stood and we stood with him. He said, If anything develops on the way there, I'll radio the helicopter. We all shook hands and Walsh said, If you need to stay overnight, find a room. I replied, Don't expect to see us until we've found Harry. Good luck. We left Walsh's office, returned to our desks, shut down our computers and gathered our belongings, then took the elevator to the lobby. The car and driver were waiting for us outside, and on the way to the heliport, Kate asked me,
"What do you think?"
"I think you should never go to the office on your day off. No good deed goes unpunished."
"I was fortunate to be here."
She asked,
"I mean, what do you think about Harry?"
"Based on my experience and on statistics, the most probable explanation for any disappearance, especially that of an adult male, is an accident that hasn't yet been discovered, a suicide, or a planned disappearance. Rarely is foul play involved." She thought about that and asked me,
"Do you think he had an accident?"
"No."
"Suicide?"
"Not Harry."
"Do you think he's just goofing off someplace?"
"No."
"So..."
"Yes." We didn't speak for the rest of the ride. Chapter 18. A few helicopters sat on the pad, and ours was easy to spot because it had FBI markings, which most FBI aircraft don't. I prefer to travel and arrive in unmarked conveyances, but the pilot explained that this was the only chopper available on short notice. No big deal. We climbed aboard the helicopter, a Bell Jet Ranger, and it lifted from its pad on the East River and followed the river north. To my left was the towering skyline of Manhattan Island, and to my right, the mysterious flatlands of Brooklyn and Queens, where I rarely venture. We continued north over the Hudson, following the majestic river valley. In less than 10 minutes, we passed over the Tappan Zee Bridge, and a few minutes later, we were flying over open countryside on both sides of the valley as we continued to follow the Hudson River northbound. I'm not a big fan of the great outdoors, but from up here, the landscape was a spectacular panorama of small towns, farms, and trees whose autumn leaves were glowing in the bright sunlight. Kate said,
"We should get a weekend house up here."
I knew that was coming.
"Wherever we go, she wants a weekend house, or a beach house, or a summer house, or a ski house, or whatever. We're up to, I think, 14 houses."
I replied, as I always do, "Great idea." The Hudson River, America's Rhine, sparkled in the sunlight, and we could see mansions and castles along the high riverbanks. I said, "There's a nice castle with a for sale sign." She ignored this and said,
"Sometimes I think I want to chuck it all and get a place in the country and just live a normal life. Do you ever think about that?"
I'd heard this before, too, not only from Kate, but from other people since 9/11. The media shrinks were explaining it as post-traumatic stress, war anxiety, fear of another attack, the anthrax scare, and so forth. I replied, "I was ready to pack it in last year, as you recall, but after the attacks, I knew I wasn't going anywhere. I'm motivated." She nodded.
"I understand, but I keep thinking that it's going to happen again, and next time it could be worse. Maybe anthrax, or poison gas, or a radiological device."
I didn't respond. She said,
"People have left the city, John."
"I know. It's much easier now to get a cab and a dinner reservation."
"This is not funny."
"No, it's not funny. In fact, I knew people who, since 9/11, had bought places in the country, or bought boats for a quick escape, or simply moved to Dubuque. This was not healthy, though it may have been smart." I said to Kate, "I'm older than you, and I remember a time when things were different. I don't like the way these bastards have made us live. I'd like to live long enough to see things get better, and I'd like to be part of making them better." I added, "I'm not running." She didn't have a response for that, and we both gazed out the windows at the pleasant autumn landscape. On the west bank of the Hudson, The United States Military Academy at West Point came into view, its tall, Gothic spires capturing the sunlight. I could see a formation of cadets on the parade grounds. Kate said, "Things are not going to get better in your lifetime or mine. You never know. Meanwhile, we'll give it our best shot." She thought a moment and said, "This thing with Harry, it has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism, but it's all part of the same problem."
"How's that?"
"It's all about people who are engaged in some sort of power struggle. Religion, politics, war, oil, terrorism. The world is headed for something much worse than anything we've seen so far."
"Probably. In the meantime, let's find Harry."
She stared out the window. Kate is physically brave, as I saw when Mr. Khalil was using us for target practice with his sniper rifle. But the last year was taking its toll on her emotional health. Also, for those of us working in this business, it didn't help our mental health to read the classified memos we got every day concerning this or that domestic threat. That, plus the looming war with Iraq, was starting to fray the nerves of some of the people I was working with. Kate had good days and bad days, as we all do. Today was not a good day. In fact, September 10th, 2001, was really the last good day. Part 9. Monday. Upstate New York. Given the magnitude of the federal response to a suspected WMD incident, first responders might be reluctant to initiate the mechanisms to set that response in motion. Terrorism in the United States. FBI Publications, 1997. Chapter 19. 2 hours and 15 minutes after we'd left the downtown Manhattan heliport, we flew over the upstate town of Saranac Lake. A few minutes later, three long runways forming a triangle came into view, surrounded by forest. I thought I saw bears lurking at the edge of the clearing. As we descended, I could see some snazzy corporate jets parked on the ramp, though only one of them sported a corporate logo on the tail. In the case of corporate jets, it did not pay to advertise, partly for security reasons, and partly because it pissed off the stockholders. Nevertheless, I looked for a jet that was marked GOCO, but didn't see any identifying markings as we hovered lower. The pilot spoke to someone on the radio, then put the chopper down on the pavement behind a long, wood-shingled building that looked like an Adirondack lodge. This building seemed a little incongruous for an airport, but I knew from my infrequent trips into these mountains that the locals took their faux rustic stuff seriously, and I was surprised that the hangars didn't look like log cabins. Anyway, the pilot shut down the helicopter's engine, and the noise level dropped dramatically. The co-pilot jumped out of the cockpit, swung open the door of the cabin, and took Kate's hand as she jumped down. I followed without taking the fellow's hand, and said to him over the sound of the slowing rotor blades, "Did you see any bears?" "Huh? Never mind. Are you staying?"
"No. We'll fuel up, then head back to New York."
As he spoke, I spotted a fuel truck coming in our direction, which is quicker service than I get at my gas station. It must have something to do with the FBI markings on the chopper. I turned and looked around the mostly empty tarmac. The corporate jets were parked in a row on a blacktop ramp in the distance, and beyond them was a scattering of smaller light airplanes. There was no activity to speak of. It was much colder up here, and I could see my breath, which is not what I wanted to see at 1:30 in the afternoon on a sunny day in early October. Kate said,
"Smell that air."
"I don't smell anything."
"The mountain air, John. And look at those trees and those mountains.
Where the hell are we?"
"In God's country."
"Good. I have a few questions to ask him." Apparently, the Adirondack Lodge building was the main passenger terminal, and we walked around to the front entrance, which had a covered veranda surrounded by a rustic railing. There was a picnic table and Pepsi machine on the veranda, and a security guy was sitting there smoking a cigarette. No one would mistake this place for JFK International Airport. Kate said to me, "I'll call Tom."
"Why?"
"Maybe someone is supposed to meet us here."
"Well, I don't see how they can miss us."
In fact, there wasn't another soul around, and there were hardly more than a dozen vehicles in the parking lot, half of which were probably abandoned by people who had one-way tickets out of this godforsaken wilderness. We entered the terminal, which was much warmer than the frozen Alpine Valley outside. The terminal interior was small, functional, and quiet. As small and isolated as this place was, there was a security checkpoint, complete with a walk-through metal detector and a baggage scanner. There were no security people at the checkpoint, and no passengers for that matter, so I assumed there was no imminent departure. Kate scanned the empty terminal and said, "I don't see anyone who might be here to meet us."
"How can you tell in this crowd?"
She ignored that and observed, "There are the car rental counters. There's a restaurant, and there are the restrooms. Where do you want to start?"
"Over here."
I turned toward the Seoul airline ticket counter, whose logo said, "Continental Commute Air." Kate asked,
"What are you doing?"
"Let's see what Harry was supposed to find here."
"That's not what Tom..."
"Fuck Tom." She considered that and agreed,
"Yeah, fuck him."
I approached the small ticket counter where an imposing middle-aged woman and a young man sat on stools, watching us. They looked like brother and sister, and unfortunately, I think their parents were too. The lady, whose name tag said Betty, greeted us.
"Good afternoon. How can I help you?"
I replied, "I need a ticket to Paris."
"Would you like to go through Albany or Boston?"
"How about neither?"
Betty informed me, "Sir, there are no direct flights to anywhere from here, except to Albany and Boston."
"You're kidding. How about arriving flights?"
"Same. Albany and Boston. Continental Commute Air. 2 flights a day. You just missed the last flight to Boston."
She cocked her thumb at the arrival and departure schedules on the wall behind her and informed us,
"We go to Albany at 3 p.m.
1 airline, 2 cities, 2 flights to each city. That made my job a little easier and quicker. I said to her, "I'd like to speak to the manager."
"You're speaking to her?"
"I thought you were the ticket agent."
"I am."
"I hope you're not also the pilot." Kate seemed impatient with my silliness and pulled out her creds.
"FBI, ma'am. I'm Special Agent Mayfield, and this is Detective Corey, my assistant. May we speak to you in private?"
Betty looked at us and said,
"Oh, you're the people who just landed in the helicopter."
I guess big news traveled fast here.
"Yes, ma'am.
Where can we go to check out passenger manifests?" She slid off her stool, told her assistant Randy to hold down the fort, then said to us,
"Follow me."
We went around the counter and through an open door into a small, empty office with desks, computers, faxes, and other electronic things. She sat at one of the desks and asked Kate, I don't think she liked me,
"What do you need?"
Kate replied,
"I need a list of passengers who arrived here on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and today. Also, departing passengers for those days, plus tomorrow."
"Okay." I asked her, "Has anyone else been here or called you in the last few days to ask about passenger manifests?" She shook her head.
"Nope."
"If someone had called or been here when you weren't here, would you know about it?" She nodded.
"Sure. Jake, Harriet, or Randy would have told me."
Maybe Kate was right, and I should do what a lot of my colleagues have done and get a job as chief of police in a small town where everybody knows everybody else's business. Kate could get a job as a school crossing guard. I'd spend all my time at the local tavern, and she'd have an affair with a forest ranger. I said to Betty, Okay, can you print out those passenger lists? Betty swiveled around and banged away at the keyboard. As the printer started grinding out paper, I looked at a few pages and said, "Not too many people on these flights." Betty replied as she hit the keys, "These are commuter aircraft, 18 passengers maximum." That was good news. I asked her, "And these are all the arriving and departing passengers for the days in question?" "As of right now. I can't tell you who's actually going to depart on the 3 o'clock Albany flight, or any flights tomorrow, but I'm getting you the reservation lists for those flights." "Good. Do you have a record of incoming and departing private aircraft?" I asked her. "No, this is an airline. Private aircraft is general aviation, and the ramp operations office takes care of that." "Of course. What was I thinking? So, where's the ramp operations office?"
"The other end of the terminal."
Before I could say this place wasn't big enough to have another end, Betty added, "They'd have a record of incoming or departing aircraft only if they spent the night or bought fuel." That's what I like about this job. You learn something new every day about something you'll never use for the rest of your life. Kate asked,
"Can you get us those records?"
"I'll send Randy to get a copy for you."
She picked up the phone and said to her assistant,
"Do me a favor, sweetie, and go down to ramp operations."
She explained what she needed, hung up, and said to both of us,
"Can I ask why you need these passenger lists?"
Kate replied,
"We're not at liberty to say, and I need to ask you not to mention this to anyone."
I added, "Not even Jake, Harriet, or Randy." Betty nodded absently while making a mental list of all the people she was going to tell about her visit from the FBI. In a few minutes, Randy appeared and handed a few papers to Betty, who then handed them over to Kate. We both looked at the sheets. There were a couple dozen private aircraft that had been registered at the airport on the days in question, but the only information on the printout was the make, model, and tail number of the aircraft. I asked Betty, "Do you know if there's any information about who owns these aircraft?"
"No, but you can find out from the tail numbers."
"Right. Can I find out who was on board?"
"No. With general aviation, private flights, there is no record of who was on board. That's why it's called private."
"Right. God bless America." Meanwhile, Osama bin Laden could be on board a private jet and no one would know it. And now, a year after 9/11, security for general aviation was still non-existent, while commercial aviation passengers, including babies, flight crew, and little old ladies, got patted down and wanded, even on small commuter aircraft. Go figure. Kate gathered up the printouts and put them in a briefcase. I asked Betty the standard question. "You notice anything unusual this weekend?" She swiveled her chair toward us.
"Like what?"
"Why do they always ask that?" "Unusual," I said. "Like, not usual." She shook her head.
"Not that I can think of."
"More people arriving than usual?"
"Well, yeah. You get a lot of people on holiday weekends.
Summer and winter are real big up here. But fall is getting big with the leaf watchers. Then hunting begins. And then you got Thanksgiving weekend, and then Christmas, skiing, and..." I stopped her before we got to Groundhog Day and asked, "Did any of the passengers look unusual?"
"No, but you know what?"
"What?"
"Some big shot flew in from Washington."
"Was he lost?" She looked at Kate as if to say, "Who is this asshole you're with?" Kate picked up the ball.
"Who was he?" "I don't remember. Secretary of something. His name should be on the passenger manifest." "How did he arrive?"
"Commute air from Boston.
I think it was Saturday."
"Yes, Saturday. He came in on the 11 o'clock flight, and one of our security guards recognized him." Kate inquired,
"Did he rent a vehicle?"
"No.
I remember he was met by a guy from the Custer Hill Club. That's a private club about 30 miles from here. There were three other guys on that flight,
and they seemed to be together. How, I asked, did you know that the guy who met the secretary of something was from this club? The driver had a uniform on that's from the Custer Hill Club. They come here now and then to pick up passengers. She added, all four passengers got their luggage and went outside, where a van from the club was waiting for them. I nodded. Very little escaped notice in small places. Did this van from the Custer Hill Club pick up any more arriving passengers from other flights? I don't know. I might have been off duty. Did the van drop off any departing passengers? I don't know. I can't always see what's going on at curbside. Right. I didn't want to show any further interest in the Custer Hill Club, so I switched gears to a cover story and said, what we need to know is if you or anyone else saw someone who looked... How can I put this without sounding like I'm engaging in racial profiling? Anyone who looked, well, like their country of origin may have been someplace where there are lots of camels? She nodded in acknowledgement, thought a second, then replied, no, I think that kind of person would stand out. I'll bet they would. Can you do us a favor and ask around later? She nodded enthusiastically. I sure can. You want me to call you? I'll call you, or stop in. Okay, I'll ask around. She stood and stared at us. What's this about? Is something going to happen? I moved closer to Betty and said in a low tone, this has to do with the Winter Olympics in Lake Placid. Keep that to yourself. Betty processed that for a few seconds, then said, the Winter Olympics were in 1980. I looked at Kate and said, damn, we're too late. I asked Betty, hey, did anything happen? Kate gave me a mean look, then said to Betty, that's Detective Corey's way of saying we're not at liberty to discuss this. But we could use your help. Normally, this is when you give the good citizen your card, but we were doing a smoke screen now, and Kate was on top of it, so she asked Betty for her card. We'll call you. Thanks for your help. Anything I can do, just ask. She added, if those people try anything around here, we know how to handle them. I replied in my John Wayne accent, that's our job, ma'am. Don't take the law into your own hands. She made a little snorting sound, then said to us, while you're here, you might want to look into that Custer Hill Club. Why? Strange things going on up there. I felt like I was in a B-movie, where the guy from the city gets warned by a local about the creepy place on the hill, then ignores the advice, which was actually what I was going to do in Act Two. I responded noncommittally, thanks. How's the food at the restaurant? Pretty good, but a little pricey. Try the double bacon cheeseburger. Betty looked as if she'd tried several. She showed us out, and I said to Kate in a foreboding tone, whatever you do, miss, do not go to the Custer Hill Club. She smiled and said, do not order the double bacon cheeseburger. In fact, that was the first risky thing I was going to do today before going to the Custer Hill Club. Chapter 20. Out in the terminal area, I said to Kate, I'm gonna hit the men's room.
You should. You're full of shit.
Right. I'll meet you at the car rental counter. We parted company, and I freshened up and was at the car rental area within 4 minutes. Women take a bit longer. There were two car rental counters, Enterprise and Hertz, one behind the other in a small area off to the side of the terminal. The young guy behind the Enterprise counter was sitting down, reading a book. Standing behind the Hertz counter was a young lady playing with her computer. Her big breast tag read Max, which I assumed was her name and not her cup size. I said, hi, Max. I have a reservation under the name of Corey.
Yes, sir.
She found my reservation, and we went through the paperwork, which took only a few minutes. She handed me the keys to a Ford Taurus and told me how to find the rental lot, then asked me,
do you need any directions?
Do you mean in life? She giggled. No. Driving directions.
You want a map?
Sure. I took the map and said, actually, I need a place to stay. She replied, there's a rack of pamphlets over there. Lodging, restaurants, sites and stuff. Great. What's the best place around?
The Point.
What's the point? She smiled.
I don't know, John. What's the point?
She laughed.
I get people with that every time.
I'll bet. Got me. So, where would you recommend to stay?
The Point.
Okay.